welcome to the Semiconductor Insiders Podcast Series. The goal of this podcast is to bring semiconductor experts together to get to the truth about the matter at hand. We'll get right to the point and not exceed 30 minutes of your time. If you have a topic you would like us to cover, please post it on semiwiki.com and we'll get right to it. Today's topic is navigating the architecture exploration jargons and what do they mean to a chip architect. My guest today is semiconductor veteran Deepak Shankar. He is the founder of Mirrorless Design and has been involved in the architectural exploration of over 250 SoCs and processors. Deepak has published over 50 articles and presented over 30 conferences in EDA, semiconductors, and embedded computing. Good morning, Deepak, and welcome to our podcast.
Hey, Dan. Thanks a lot for having me here. I really enjoy listening to the SemiWiki podcast. I'm like really excited that now I'm in the podcast as opposed to just listening to it.
Thanks. Okay, first question I always ask is, what brought you to the semiconductor industry?
Really an accident. Cadence had spun a company out called Systems and Networks that was providing simulation solutions for people designing data centers. Back in the day, the data centers was the term that was used, just called the IT infrastructure. And one day we had Professor Alberto Sanjeevani Vincentelli come over and look at what we had and what technology we had. And he found our simulator so interesting that he felt it could be bought out by some competitor. So he turned on, went and told Joe that, hey, you got to buy this company out. And overnight, they shut down the company, bought us out, and integrated into Cadence. So that's kind of how I ended up in the semiconductor space. So my background is really about DSP and network design. And I got into this thing. So it took a lot of learning. I had to attend a Verilog class. I had to attend what place and route meant. I didn't even know what these terms meant. And one day I was sitting in a meeting, which was a review meeting, and there was this gentleman by name Joe Costello, who was in the meeting, and they were talking about this product called Verilog. So this was like within the first week of my attending, so I didn't have any training or anything. So they kept talking about Verilog this, Verilog that, we should do Verilog this, we need Verilog for this one. Midway through the meeting, I was just exasperated, and I go, what is Verilog? And there was like a deep silence for about 30 seconds. And then everybody got off and, got onto their own, going back to what they were saying earlier. So that was my entry into semiconductors. And also that the person happened to be Joe Costello, who was the CEO at that time. So lesson number one, when you're a hotshot youngster, just watch out to who's there in the meeting.
Yeah, well, Joe's got a good sense of humor. He's a neighbor of mine. He's still active in the EDA industry. It's a lot of excellent Joe Costello stories. So before I get deep into the system level design stuff, let me ask you, is architecture exploration worth the effort? I mean, have you really seen real user benefits from spending the time doing modeling, all this modeling and simulation?
Architecture exploration has been around since Gary Smith. So we're talking like 95, 96. And there are people that love it. And then there are people that absolutely hate it. There's really no borderline cases. And I think it's because the people that love it have really seen the benefit. Now, if you take processor companies, they've been doing it right from day one. When I first started working, there were architects at Intel that were modeling the Pentium processor, and they were actually doing architecture modeling. So it's not something new. The people that have really benefited from it are the folks that have really invested. So they've built a team, they've had a plan, they've decided that this is what's going to be there. They're going to be using it for the next 15 years. They always incorporate it in their schedule. So those are the types of people that have really benefited from it. I mean, having worked on, across the board, semiconductors, systems, in defense, automotive, wireless, there have been a huge number of companies that have really seen the benefit. I mean, I can give you some real life examples. One of our customers was developing a flight avionics, and their requirement was 85 different unique interfaces. they were competing against another large defense contractor. And after simulating using Visual Sim, which is our simulation software, they found that the processing requirements would cause the weight of the server to exceed the capacity or available slot on the aircraft. So they said, we're not going to bid on it. The other company went ahead, they started working on it. And within 8 months, the project was scrapped because it was true. So that architecture exploration really helped the company not lose like $10, $20, $30 million. Another company was developing a very complex FPGA with a lot of knobs on the chip and things like that. They got to show the actual chip, a model of the full chip, running some routing algorithms even before they started on the RTL. So they could get an interaction with one of their largest customers and get even feedback even before they actually started doing any development. So one of the things has to be understood is architecture exploration is not just about saying, hey, is this right or wrong? It's more of, being able to communicate. It's all about the communication. So once you realize that, then you see that architecture exploration actually impacts the whole company. So yes, architecture exploration is absolutely worth it.
Great. Hey, so the articles I read use different terms. It's a little bit confusing. Model-based systems engineering, system-level design, virtual prototyping, worst-case execution times. Are these all different, or how are they used?
It depends on which direction you come. Are you coming from the semiconductor side? Are you coming from EDA? Are you coming from avionics or defense? Are you coming from automotive? Depending on where you're coming from, the terminologies used are slightly different. So semiconductor or EDA companies really think in terms of verification. They think about code generation. They think about early software development. So, they work around, building a platform where you can just say, hey, take all these different IPs you get from different people, put it together and simulate it. Or they say, okay, on top of this, let's run software and provide this as a platform for engineers to do early software development. On the other hand, the defense industry considers this as documentation and management. So, I need to integrate my requirements. I need to, figure out what should be the sequence of events that happen. What should be the platform. So they are more, expansive. They cover a lot of information. They involve a lot more people within the company. So, for example, in the defense industry, you might find the mechanical engineer, the thermal engineer, the software engineer, the hardware engineer, the embedded systems guy, the systems engineer. They all work off a system. That's why it's called model-based systems engineering. And, there's a really good standards organization called OMG, or Object Management Group, that really works with all of these companies and really builds up the platform. So, they have a very well-defined terminology. Now, system-level design was something that Gary Smith brought up. And, he had a vision. He was a true visionary. He had a vision and he said, yep, we should think as a whole system. Back in those days, the system was really processor core, north bridge, south bridge, and PCI and memory. But he knew that when you're looking at a chip, you have to look at everything, not just the processor core or things like that. That's why he named it system level design. Now, worst case execution time is actually interesting. It's actually from the software world, because the software engineers want to make sure that when they schedule something, it completes within a time schedule. They want to make sure that what is the worst case, so that when they design the sequence and they have a deterministic end-to-end time schedule, they would actually be able to complete it no matter what problems they have, whether either there's a resource limitation or there is lack of processing resource, or a semaphore is unavailable. They would have knowledge of that. That's where worst case execution time becomes important. So think about it as twofold. One is which direction you're coming from, and what is the type of question you're trying to answer. That's what determines which terminology you use.
All right. So let's talk about power. Power is a big deal. I see power aware, low power, power management, power gating. What aspect of power should I focus on at the architecture exploration phase?
First and foremost, You should not look at power in isolation. Except for a very few handful of companies, everybody looks at power as, oh yeah, here, let me, after I finished everything and afterthought, let me do power. No, absolutely the wrong thing to do. The right thing to do is integrate your performance, functionality, and power into one system level model. So, you know, you want to be able to know, if I change the clock speed here, or I change the bus topology here, what does it all affect? Does it affect my latency? Does it affect my instant power? Does it affect my average power? Does it affect the arbitration scheme that I want to use, which makes it a bigger chip? I need to understand all of those, because not only does it affect your packaging, your thermal cooling, all of those things, but it also starts looking at the mechanical effects. You know, how much of additional capacity do I have on this board? You know, how many chips can I actually put on this board? So power must be thought about as integrated with your entire design process. That's one piece of it. Power aware just means that, you know, I know exactly for this architecture, this is the amount of power that it's going to consume. If I change the architecture, this is how much the percentage of change happens. Low power is kind of a misnomer. You're doing a reduced power. So, you know, if I'm running this process at 2 gigahertz and I want to reduce it down to 1 gigahertz because I don't have enough battery, that's kind of a low power. But you can also say, hey, my IoT must be at the absolute lowest power that it can consume. Again, a form of low power. Power management, very popular in wireless, but now in everything you have power management, which is how do I, you know, shut down everything as when things are not being used, so that way I can save a huge amount of power. And power gating is kind of related, which is, you know, if certain devices are not being used for a certain period of time, I bring it down. And obviously the risk there is I got transition power, I got the capacitance and inductance, so, you know, I might actually end up consuming more power than actually saving. So I got to be looking at all of it. But integrated power analysis is the only way you can get to that, the utopia of power.
Okay. Let's talk about AI. What role does AI play, if any, in solution feasibility and tuning parameter configuration?
One of the biggest problems in system design is the lack of information. We just don't have enough data within a company to say, you know, if I did this, it'll impact it. So for example, say I have a benchmark and, the board runs at this, runs at 20 milliseconds. I run a simulation and I find that they're running in 6 milliseconds. Where do I go? Where do I figure out what is wrong with that particular model? AI can become a tremendous partner in that, because it can tell you, hey, if you're doing it out in milliseconds, you should be looking at the memory. If I'm in microseconds, I should look at the cache. So then what happens is it starts looking at data that's available from previous runs or from different runs and saying, okay, if I did this combination of overhead on my L2 cache, or I increase the or reduce the clock speed on the memory, that is going to reduce my power. Increase my latency. The only way I can really do that in a fully automated manner is incorporating AI. So, you know, the model starts learning about what are the impacts. If I do A, I get E. So once I understand that, then, you know, the AI starts making you far more productive. Now, we have actually done some market research. Matter of fact, we're looking at getting some products out during the DAC timeframe, where we're looking at probably about a 60-70% productivity improvement for architects just by incorporating AI as a simple way of just learning from prior runs of a model. So the future for system design is definitely AI. It definitely is going to do a rapid optimization and accelerate your model construction.
Hey, you know, I was going to ask about academia. Can experiments with architecture trade-off in college help students be more impactful when they enter the semiconductor design workspace?
Very interesting question. Depending on which university you come from, the the role of education is fairly different. You know, some of them are more skill-based, some of them are more theoretical-based. I think there's a middle ground where architecture trade-offs can play a major role. So if it's just being, you know, like do more projects, you don't get to learn the foundation. If you just do theory, you don't get to do the projects, you don't get a hands-on experience. Architecture trade-off kind of bridges the gap, because when you do your modeling, you get to know what are all the different aspects of that particular IP or that particular device is. While at the same time, when you make changes, you see how it impacts the report. How does it impact the latency, or how does it impact the buffer occupancy? So from a learning standpoint, I believe that students can kind of bridge the gap between the theory and the practical and understand, you know, why they're studying certain things, and also understand when they do it, how does it impact the system. So I think overall, I think overall it's going to be a very profitable and a very useful tool for college students to, you know, right before they enter the workspace. Because once they come into the workspace, boom, they're ready to go. When somebody says pipeline or PowerScape, they immediately know what it means. I think it's a really big boon for them.
Great. Hey, one final question, Deepak. What does the future hold for architecture exploration? I mean, what will decide the best platform, the simulator speed, IP availability, or something else? Final thoughts?
You know, architecture exploration is really about understanding your system. So as I mentioned earlier, it's not about right or wrong. And I think the future is really bridging the gap between requirements and manufacturing. So I had a boss at Cadence, David Thorne, a brilliant marketing guy, but also a guy who was out to, you know, do a lot of fun stuff. What David would do is he'd bring out these slides that, you know, you press a button and asks you a bunch of questions. Oh, you want an MPEG decoder, and you want to go to TSMC, and you want to go to 7 nanometer, and you want to go to a low power, click on a button and boom, pops out a chip, right? Architecture exploration is kind of the same thing. It has to incorporate more and more of your design, more and more of your layout, more and more of your design for test, design for manufacturability, but also being more and more aware of the manufacturing process. So you want to start moving more of the information that's involved in manufacturing and testing up front to before you start the development. I think that is where we're going to start seeing the future of architecture exploration. The more of that information is available to you in the architecture phase, the more productive you're going to be. So, you know, you're going to find that you need more of that data here. So that's one piece of it. Of course, the second piece of it is the reason that most companies do not deploy architecture simulation is because they just don't have the IP. If I want the a cycle-active processor model of, say, a very advanced processor, I just can't get it from the vendor because they don't build it. So there are only like a few sources, like, you know, Mirabus Design is one. I mean, we do provide, but there's very, very few sources of IP availability. So unless that IP availability expands, the future is still grim for architecture exploration. And that's why we have invested huge sums of money on IP availability, huge teams that are going out and, you know, like capturing the entire world. So IP availability is a very important thing. Simulator speed, everybody wants to get the fastest, but, you know, every 6 months, Intel puts out a new chip, or Apple puts out a new chip, so you automatically get 40-50% acceleration. There's a new DRAM, you get a little more acceleration. So simulator speed is no longer going to be something that people are going to consider critical. But I think, you know, the speed of modeling, which is, you know, the IP availability, connecting requirements to manufacturing, those are going to be the thing that's going to hold the future. So that's what's going to make this, architecture exploration really feasible.
Great conversation. Thank you, Deepak. This concludes our podcast. So thank you for your time. And I want to thank the audience for listening. And we'll speak with you again next week.
Thanks a lot, Dan. This was really a very interesting and pretty attractive podcast.
That concludes our podcast. Thank you all for listening and have a great day.